Yep, that did it. Broadcast enough. Thank you, Jose. Actually, I'll have to get you. When I get done, I'll have to get you set to most of. Is that other one even coming on? Look on the underneath the glass table right there on the left. There's a computer on top of it there. Oh, well, don't worry about that. Later on, I'll go back there and turn it on. It's right, it's on the, underneath the glass table on the left. It's the tall computer standing on top of it. Just hit the button and it'll crank up. It must have got overheated or something. Because I
don't know this. And the
communist
company was not a good place to be. So in 1969, I got a
no, it's underneath the table. Sitting on top of another computer. There's one computer laid flat and another one standing on top of it. That used to be the main broadcast server, but it's a little flaky these days, so I just use it for other stuff.
Well,
I was with your mama. Seen her earlier. Seen a happy camper being here, but she's. It's about halfway down. I think it's on the left or the right. It's a little round button, about halfway down the computer. It's on one of the left or right side, about halfway down.
In order to write this series of books, which have been on my mind for ever since I left the
city. Come on, don't do that shit.
Now I'm on, I had a 4-volume
published. Well, I'm going to show you how to turn on Winamp.
I got 5 more to go.
Let's see. I ain't going to make you do it right now because I'm not using it. That's the one that goes to the home page, which sucks when I come to the home page. Okay, fucking right now. Where is the software for this? MBE Studio or something.
We're glad to have you here chronicling it. I wouldn't ask for anybody else.
He's still sitting by the computer. You know that one you turned off, Spreaker? Looking at it as like a round black circle. It says like OB something or OBS or something. I don't know. It's a soft. It's something. It's what I use to broadcast on for YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
That shit need to be updated. Yeah, everything probably needs updated because I ain't been there in a week. But I don't need to wait until I get there, no fuckers. Yeah.
That's perfect. So I guess, tell me a little bit about this situation that follows you around.
But what, did you see the name? That's all I need is a name. You don't have to open it. I use hover over the thing and tell me what it says, initials. OBS? Okay, that's all I need. OBS Studios. Okay.
So I thought, well, you're
still an
excellent platform for, I guess, paranormal.
Yeah, this is,
And I thought this might be the place to talk about.
I got this originally from it, that's it. For a window. So this is what allows you to hook your video features up to YouTube. And it also allows us to broadcast live there. But anyway, I'm going to get something to eat upstairs, but I'll talk at you. If you need me, holler at me.
Other than the superficial things one learns in school and, you know, that quarter hour of history that might be dedicated to the subject. And I'm somewhat of a perspective subject. Trained as a physicist, studied for about 5 years in Transylvania physics, theoretical physics and mathematics. So I have a bit of a professional deformation, if you want to. I can, maybe it's not ATD, but not that problem. So I want to do things right. And my readers, I have rewarded me with great reviews, recognizing the amount of detail and accuracy that I put into my story. So when it came to issues of Islam, I said, let me go and try to learn something about it. Well, it's been a long process and I'm still learning, but I started in 2008 in Marrakesh. And the place where I used to hang out with my wife every day, you know that they don't serve alcohol there, which is a big mistake, I think. But we used to hang out at the cafe where they had a very good mint tea. And it's a favorite tourist spot. It's got about 5 stories. And there's a terrace on the roof. But from there, you look down to the market where there are all the snake charmers and carpet sellers and anything in the world. And I think in the old days, it used to be a slave market. So like I said, every evening we'd go out there and have our tea and so forth. After I left, I don't know, a few weeks later, that cafe was blown up by terrorists, and 17 French tourists died. So, all right, well, that's interesting. I could have been there myself, but then you guys would be leaving somebody else's restaurant to it. Next one, in 2009, I took a trunk full of those books, and I as far away from my home as possible, and we went to Chile, South America. And I did a lot of research and quiet, and I could concentrate. And did some driving around, looking at the country, especially the wine country between Santiago and Valparaiso on the sea. Until they, like every day or every other day, drive through that wine valley to the ocean. And then when we left, I'd say less than a week later, there was a huge earthquake in Chile that affected the very road where the earthquake created gaps in the road of like, 10 foot across or something. And subsequently, there was a tsunami, like more than 2,000 people were killed. And I said, damn, this thing is kind of following me. I'm saying, trying to see a map. Third one is, I was fixing, as we say in Texas, to this trouble. By the way, Jeff, can you hear me? I don't hear anything from you.
Yes, I hear you. Yeah, okay. I'm here.
So, fixing to go to Istanbul to meet with some professors at the University of Istanbul to discuss some specific incidents that happened that affected Dracula. Dracula spent a few years in the Ottoman Empire, which for reasons are not yet introduced to that part of history, is the Turkish Empire. This is the Ottoman Empire that was formed around 1300 AD and lasted until World War I. In about 1918, it was dissolved. We're talking about a 600-year stretch. It's the longest lasting empire in the modern era. And Dracula spent a few years as a hostage there. And there were certain important events that took place that historians haven't been able to explain. So I have some theories on my own, having studied at the History Institute in Romania, in Bucharest, and I picked up some vibes here and there, and I formed a theory about what happened. Some of those incidents are covered in Volume 3, and then Volume 4, but the Volume 3 specifically. And then I went there to talk to the historian, talk to the head of the history department, Dr. Chakar, and asked him if my theory of what happened is plausible. You know, nobody knows the exact truth about it, but as I said, for me it's important to get it as right as possible to a plausible reality. And unfortunately, the good doctor confirmed that there was nothing wrong with my theory. He couldn't say, yeah, you're right, that's how it happened, but he said, I don't see anything wrong. I said, so
Jeff Fluffy writes in a historical fiction for the best when things are not well documented. So, I'm preparing to go to the session with the university, and I got my tickets in hand, and we have already packed, and I think it was the next morning we're going to talk. And then I've seen the news that in Istanbul, there is the biggest flood it had in more than 100 years, and they show like wall of water rushing down the main street right past the hotel and carrying cars, and it was a complete disaster there. So I had to cancel my trip, and we went to Barcelona, sat and loafed on the beach where I was bothered by a lot of interfere with my, but I hope to be the best of it. Yes. Next one is somewhat even more troubling because it could be a huge disaster, and I'm referring to a visit I took a little bit after Istanbul to Egypt. Once again, well, obviously, in Istanbul, I studied things in Turkey, where I lived there many times. I studied things more directly related to Dracula's sojourn in the Ottoman Empire, and also trying to understand the mojo of the Sultans and so forth. But Egypt, I went as a continuation of my understanding of Islam. And while there, I decided to go to the Sinai Peninsula, where in the center of the peninsula there is a monastery called St. Matthew's Monastery that has been in operation since about 300 AD. In other words, I'm told that it's the longest operating monastery in continuous operation in the world. And I got to see this, plus the possibility of some events taking place there sometime in volume 9, I think, 8 or 9. So I'm planning ahead, as you can see. I'm a bit anal about planning, so I look forward to that. And the other thing, as a side issue, if you write a multi-volume novel, you really have to catch up in your mind where are you going, you have a blueprint of where you're going, otherwise you're likely to start in some wrong direction and find yourself in a blind alley. So, whereas I'm focusing primarily at the volume of things, I always look to the remaining volumes I have to make sure that my current action is going to be congruent with what's coming up down the road. So, for this purpose, I said I'm going to visit this monastery. So, we went to Sharm el Sheikh on the Red Sea, and from there we hired a chauffeur limousine to take us into the center of the peninsula. It is an area, the large area there that is a international mandate. In other words, it's an international law enforcement group there that protects that area. And so you cannot go in unless you have a valid passport, and there's a number of security checks, machine guns up on top of the huts there pointing at your car. It's kind of a eerie atmosphere at the end of the zone. And eventually, we went ready to hang out the side of the road and sell you trinkets and half covers and things like that. Very quaint. It's certainly worth visiting. And the landscape is like the other. There's no vegetation. It's all brown and rocky and so forth. Like, we get to the monastery, we do our visitation there, and the point of interest is something readers might find remarkable is that this monastery is the only Christian religious establishment in the world that has within its own distance a working mosque. So how could it be? How could the Christians and the Muslims worship within the premises of the same building? In fact, this monastery is surrounded by walls. It's like a fortress in the desert, and yet inside the walls there is a mosque that is frequented by Muslims, and it's a cooperation. Well, the explanation for this extraordinary phenomenon is that at the time when Prophet Muhammad was just getting started, just making his bones, and he was supported by what we had given some aid, some assistance from the monks of that monastery. I don't know, nobody knows the details of how that happened. But in thankfulness for that action, Muhammad gave them a document signed with an imprint of his paw, because Muhammad couldn't read or write. Somebody wrote that document and he put ink on his palm and put his thumbprint on the document to ascertain that he's signed by him. But in that document, he offered protection forever to his monastery against anybody, especially against Muslims who would have reasons to attack them. And in recognition of that, the monks in the monastery allowed the mosque to be built there. I think this is something that's never spoken about. You know, whenever this subject of conflict between Islam and Christianity comes up, and this is, I think, it's a beautiful example of possible cooperation. Now, why would Muslims be interested on worshiping in a Christian environment? Well, the reason is that the monastery is at the foot of Mount Sinai. And for those who are familiar with the Old Testament, that's the place where Moses went up the mountain and received his Ten Commandments. So therefore, it's the holy site in both Islam, and Islam recognizes Moses as one of the prophets, so it's a holy site in both Christians and Muslims. Well, so I did a visit, came home, and very few months later, we have the Arab Spring. You remember there was a series of revolutions that swept across North Africa, and Egypt was involved in that. And Mount Sinai became, Sinai Peninsula became a very unstable area, and there were a lot of terrorists back there. And then a couple of people about the same age as my wife and I, Americans, took the same group that I did. They rented the car and they went to the monastery, but never got there because on the way there they were kidnapped by rebels. And I don't know what happened to them, but certainly I looked back at it and saying, boy, that could have been me again. So I put that on the list of things. Something is following me, not closely enough, and that is there. The last item, should I continue that? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
I was just looking at
the player at the website, you can start working. But yeah, I'm here. As far as Dracula, that's the thing that's so interesting, is that he was a Christian, of course, and then through the Order of the Dragon, and that whole thing was a battle. Forces of darkness in the name of Christ. The fight against the serpent, against his wife. So that when his father was sent back to Transylvania to become the governor of Transylvania, appointed by the emperor, the Romanian peasants of Transylvania heard him being referred to as Drache, which is dragon in German, and they interpreted that as Dracul. Well, Dracul in Romania means the devil. So I leave it up to you. You have to draw that connection, but there is a connection there between dragon, devil, and ultimately Dracula, some kind of a connection. And then when Vlad himself became known for his natural disease, he was nicknamed Dracula, which meant Subway, son of the dragon. So that's the origin of the name. It says it's explained a little more in volume one of the series. Now, back to the comments. I was in Bucharest for several months in 2011, researching at the Romanian National Institute of History, and I made friends with the director of the institute, and I picked his brain as much as I could about it, and he said, well, here's a little known phenomenon. When when Vlad was preparing to take power in 1456, in a couple months before, there, a month or so before he actually took power, there was a comet across the sky and was visible for several days. And everybody thought this was a bad omen, because as you would believe, if you read the staff of things, there was a comet that takes place in that year, which was 1444. In those days, people, and I would say even today, those people were believed that phenomena such as the comet portended the death of very important people, kings usually. And because it happened many times in history, that became a firm belief. Well, when they told Vlad that he was taking power, they told him, maybe you ought to put it off for a season or two, because this is not good. You know, that you might just be affected by the curse of these comets. And he said, screw that, you know, and he seized power, and then that wasn't good enough. The first silver coin that he had struck had the image of a comet on the back. Now that is an absolute no-no. Nobody's ever done that before, because it's like bringing the curse F2, not just seeing it out there on the sky. And the doctor, the professor, and the Bucharest Institute took me to a cabinet where only scientists have access and took out these coins. The only one coin was found ever from the reign of Vladimir Taylor, Dracula, and it's about the size of a dime, and on the back it has this comet. So what this tells me, as a writer, as I'm trying to reconstitute the character of this man, it tells me what kind of a ball this guy is. Because you have to understand, in 15th century, these things were not taken lightly. You know, today we can wink at them, some people more seriously than others. But at that time, he was, you know, wrong. And for him to go against such an omen, not only to ignore warnings of becoming a king at the wrong time, but then to strike a coin with a comet, that's just something.
Definitely, and that comet story is very fascinating. I've read something about, you know, there's a lot of comet stuff with King Arthur, but King Arthur showed that we had so much chance, you know, what's real and what it's not and all that, but I know there was something about King Arthur and a comet as well. And I remember I had a weird comet experience that I'll never forget, when that hell boss went through that time and everybody was freaking out saying there was something behind it on like coast to coast and stuff. I was out there in my driveway at the Indian style, like looking at that thing. It was weird. Comets are weird. I don't know what the hell they are, but
we did something there. That's just the one just comes back predictably every so many hundreds of years. You cannot say, what the hell's going on? Who's taking a second look at that?
So when it comes to Blackie and Taylor's acts of taking care of the state, and you know, you see the wood cutting of him sitting at the table in the cup, and supposedly a drop came down, a tear came down there in his face. Explain to us, like, how was the Pope and stuff acting? Were they really, like, acting like he was a hero and trying to amp it up? Because I know there was a lot of propaganda paperwork back then that was showing, you know, camp or something, you know, the way he, you know, kill people and stuff. I mean, he was like a hero to them, wasn't he?
Well, first of all, to this day, he's a national hero in Romania. Very few people know, but it's pretty mind-boggling that he is a national hero. That's how I knew him, until I left the country. And on the anniversary of his alleged death in 1976, the government issued a commemorative stamp, a postal stamp. Now, you don't make stamps with Jack the Ripper, you know. Obviously, the Romanians believe that whatever he did was the right thing to do. But the depictions that we see, those are the images that we have on the web, poor future wasn't as developed at the time. They were executed by veterans. I mean, when your story is told by those people whose relatives you failed, it's hard to believe they're going to give you a fair representation. In fact, it is that aspect of being misperceived that has driven me to write this book. I think I told you perhaps last time that when I arrived in Chicago, I saw the name Dracula on the market, and it kind of blew me away. How could the American know about Dracula when Romania is such a small country? I didn't expect anybody who have heard about him. So people say, oh, everybody knows Dracula. Are you kidding? Where do you go? Go back to your country. And then I discovered that, yes, everybody around the world. I interviewed small children in Japan asking about Dracula, which they pronounced Dracula. Everybody knows it, but only as the town of the vampire. Well, if he wasn't a town, he was a king. And if he was a vampire, well, that's kind of his hobby, but he really was a warrior. So at that time in Chicago, on that day, I decided when I grow up, I'm going to write a book. In the book, I would consider the vampire representation of Dracula to be the face of prostitution. In my book, it's the defense. So I'm writing the story from the defense side to say, let me tell you last side of the story, and then let the readers decide. Well, going back to all the propaganda that was happening, being that it was written by his enemy, and it was juicier than the truth, it got a lot of circulation. All the pamphlets that were written about his impaling left and right were circulated in several languages in Europe, and I read one place that it was the second bestseller after the Bible.
How
about the Pope? What was the Pope's view on that? Can you hear me, Jeff?
Yeah, I can hear you, and I just heard you talk about the bestseller and the Pope, what the Pope said about it. I can hear you fine, yes.
Yeah, so I want to tell you about the Pope. Well, the way I look at the Pope's reaction is through a game, more or less through a scientific lens. That is, I don't care much of propaganda on either side. I want to know what the facts are. What did the Pope do? Well, the Pope we're talking about is Pope Pius II, who used to be called Ennio Flavius Piccolomini. And you will meet him in my book before he becomes Pope, a very fascinating character. And there are good reasons to know that he and Dracula knew each other. But when he became Pope, 1458, his main agenda was, and that was his election platform, if you will, fighting Islam. That was his program. And he realized that at the forefront of his fight against Islam was the land where Dracula was king. That was called Wallachia, which is part of the Romanian country now that is between Danube and the Carpathian Mountains with the capital of Bucharest. So if you go to Bucharest, you have Wallachia. Across the mountains, if you go past the famous Vlad Castle, you are in Transylvania, and that's where Vlad was born. So the Pope started intending aggressive move by the Church. The Church has spending over the first 100 years for the first 150 years of the empire, all the way from Asia Minor, which is Anatolia, present-day Eastern Turkey. If you look at the map, it's just for the capital of Turkey, in Ankara, so from about there, or Bursa, they spent even 150 years to engulf or conquer most of the Balkans. Good part of Greece, and Bulgaria was totally taken over. And then the border reached, at the time of my story,
the border between Islam and Christianity was the Danube. On one side, on the right bank of the Danube, we have the Turks and Islam. On the left bank, you have Dracula and Christianity. And that's where the battle line was drawn. The Pope was very cognizant of this fact and sent all sorts of encouragement for resistance against this invasion. They knew the invasion would come. Now, the plan the Turks had under the leadership of Mehmed II, who managed to conquer Constantinople and turn it into Istanbul of today, at the age of 21, he conquered that on May 29, 1453. His plan was to take the rest of Europe as well. He saw himself as heir to the Roman Empire. And he wasn't satisfied to just rule the part of the former Eastern Roman Empire. He wanted the whole shebang. And for him to go to Rome, he had to go overland because he did not have a navy at the time. And to go overland, it meant crossing the Danube, and on the other side of the Danube, Vlad, he then had to wait for him. While the Pope says, don't let him come through, sending all sorts of encouragement, and unfortunately, did not send him a bunch of gold, which would have been very useful for Vlad to build a strong army. And we will fast forward here over the events of that confrontation between Mehmed II and Vlad the Impaler, which is of monumental importance to the history of Europe, because Vlad actually stopped the invasion, and Mehmed was forced to go back home with a failed in his leg, and never again managed to conquer anything north of the Danube after that. So Vlad put an end to his dream, right, in 1462. And that will be detailed, I think, in Volume 6. But at the end of this battle, at the end of this war, which took all of the summer of 1462, something extraordinarily unusual happened. Instead of being hailed as a hero by the Western powers, Vlad was arrested by the Hungarian king and taken as a prisoner in chains to Buda. There was no Budapest at that time. Budapest was for later, they just happened to Buda was there. That was the royal place, the royal palace was in Buda. And took him there. And the ostensible reason for this arrest was that somebody, enemies of Vlad, produced a letter in Latin in which purportedly Vlad was begging Mehmed forgiveness and promising him to fight up with him and help him take over Hungary and the rest. And he signed by him. Well, the problem was that the letter was written in a very poor Latin. Well, Vlad was a master in Latin, and the Pope knew that. So he got suspicious about this so-called evidence and sent a representative of the Vatican to Budapest, to Buda, to witness the trial that was conducted there, which should have resulted in Vlad being executed for three. Instead, as history shows, he wasn't executed, which says why. There's no explanation for that other than the fact that that proof fell through, that the Vatican representative put his foot down and said, wait a minute, you can't do this to a hero, and all your evidence is here. And then, so this was all supported by Pius II, who hoped to mount a new crusade against Islam and hoped to have Vlad at the head of this crusade. So when you ask me, well, what was the attitude of the Pope and so forth, you may read all sorts of things, all sorts of interpretations, but the fact that the Vlad, instead of being executed, he was kept as a prisoner there. It's, of course, much better to be a prisoner, even though it was for about 12 years, than to have your head chopped off. And then he was rehabilitated in his bed where the King of Hungary had him marry
tell us from Pope. Pope got beyond the negative propaganda and started preach to all of that in 1941. Incidentally, that cleric from Vatican who went to Buddha, his name is, I think, Michael of Magusa, he gave us the only eyewitness testimony of what blood looks like. All the other things are hearsay and imagination, but this man wrote an actual paragraph in his report to the Pope in which he described blood look. That's from where we know that he had three eyes. That he was extremely powerful in the field. He had a back like a bull. Obviously, when you wield a two-handed sword, like in the times of King Yakin, you develop some upper body muscles. And that he was, he didn't say attractive, but imposing. And we know from other stories that he was a magnet for women. So that's the angle of the Pope. Does that answer your question for
me? Yes, it did. Thanks so much. Let's get Jay in here with some questions. We kind of go back and forth. Go ahead, Jay. Can you get in there?
Yeah, I've got a couple good ones. On what type of some of you've looked at Vlad as more historical and some of the fantastical stuff that Hollywood produced you frown upon, and I'm kind of with you on that. But what I found interesting, they call him the Impaler for what he did to the invaders of his country. Yet what he did, I don't think is nearly half as bad as what most of the 39 Crusades happened. Can you give us a little bit of an example of how he was glorified in history by what he did, but you know the Crusades of the Christian Church were even worse than what Vlad ever did, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think that, well, it's a complex subject. I'll try to nibble at it a little bit. Of course, this will be a big part of my writing for volumes 6 and 7, and for those of our listeners who have read the first 2, 3, 4 volumes, they can see that I take Vlad from a time when he's a young man, and he's a very, in many cases, a very naive but extremely honest person and so forth. So he's the champion of the underdog and so forth. And just the other day, I got a commentary on my website from a reader who said, love the book, but he says, I don't see how this charming young man will become the famous killer of a few years later. So, obviously, it is an interesting arcing that I have to do there, but I'll do the best I can to answer your question. And there are several elements to that. One is, we have to consider the times throughout the world, not just in Wallachia, what it meant to deal with bandits and criminals and so forth. What were the punishments? There were no kind punishments, really. There was an immense cruelty at play here. If you ever visit one of the European castles and they show you the torture rooms, it'll make your hair stand up on end. The actual act of executing somebody, even through impaling, what is neither a novelty nor something to overly shock the people. In fact, it was kind of a nice spectacle. It was like our equivalent of a Kardashian live TV show. You know, you look at the beautiful bodies and see what happens to them. But clearly, he must have done something that went beyond the norm, and I'll get into that for a second. The Crusaders were as cruel and as unforgiving of their enemies as one could imagine, and many times that is just by necessity. You know, if you're in a foreign land, if you are deep in that land and you have scarce resources and water, and you encounter your enemy finally, you can, many times, you can't even afford to take them prison. Who's going to guard these prisons? You only have enough water for you to have or sit every other day.
what he's going to do with physics. So it was quite customary to get rid of it. And you'll see instances in my book, throughout the book, where that is the rationale for saying, hey, we were lucky. The good news is we captured 2013. This is what the Christians say. The bad news is we're going to move on. What are we going to do with that? And someone says, well, let's do it. And then they kill it and go on. Well, that's a massacre. You know, killing 2,000 people just because you ran out of peanut butter and jelly, it's kind of a mind-boggling thing. So, throughout the place was common for now, going to Blas, what could he have done to really earn the sobriquet of the tailor? Because others did tailor as well. In fact, he learned the impalement from the pit. And you said something, Jay, at the beginning that he impaled his enemies to search. Well, as much as I'm on Blas' side, I have to say, he actually impaled a whole bunch of his own people. And therein lies, perhaps, the process of speaking to his renown. And why would he do that? He killed, I would say, maybe repeatedly tens of thousands of his own people. Well, if you just leave that fact on the table and take a look at it at face value, then you say, my God, this guy is a total maniac. But that wasn't the case. When he took power in 1415, his country was bankrupt. There was no money in the royal coffers. Now, the nobility of the land, called the boyars, they had plenty of money and they had their own estate. But this, we are talking now about the end of the Middle Ages, when the transition towards the Renaissance era went. Now, Romania was much further behind the Renaissance issues than Italy and the rest of people, but the nobility of the boyars continued to still have a lot of power. And the king, if he wasn't very rich, he could hire his own mercenaries and guards and so forth. He could not overpower the lawyers. Lawyers could unite against him and then be gone. In fact, this happened again and again in the history of Latvia. And it took Vlad's genius and his ability for diplomacy and so forth to not let that happen, despite the fact that he was poor. He was destitute when he took power. And so as a country, the royal revenue came from custom taxes primarily, although there are other revenues like the salt mines, some fisheries and so forth, but the custom on commerce was the primary source of royal revenue. Well, because of the fact that I described in detail in Volume 1, the banditry in Wallachia was out of sight, the commerce had come up with a virtual well, no commerce, no custom taxes. No custom taxes, no royal revenue. And the revenue, then the king becomes more or less a figurehead. In fact, Vlad's father was a very big nobility, sort of a top of it, and left and right, and he never did conduct any major campaigns because of that. Well, Vlad wasn't going to have any of that. Yet, for him to say, how do I, and by the way, another thing that's so crucial important, having spent time with the church, he knew what they were up to, he knew their World Cup. It's like in the Game of Thrones, in the first season, when they kept saying, winter is coming, winter is coming. Well, the church were coming. He knew they were prepared to come across the land, go on their way to Rome. Well, he had a couple of choices. One was to say, let him come, when they come, I'm going to run away in the mountains and do my own thing. Or, you know, I'll fight up with them and then I'll eat from their table. Or third, and the least probable, the more insane option, to say, no, I'm going to fight them. And I'm not going to let him go if they're going to. He's like, over my dead body. That's essentially what he said to himself. Well, it's easier to set them down, because to fight an people, of which more than half were professional soldiers. You didn't have to have an army that, you know, similar size, or at least not much smaller. Well, armies cost money. For some of you need cavalry, you got to buy horses, you need weapons, and so forth. So what he said to himself, he was a very good economist, if you will. He said, my only chance to raise money is to restore commerce. To restore commerce, I must wipe out messages. I must wipe out any kind of malfeasance so that the merchants begin to move around across my country, especially who are looking at attracting foreign commerce from the Silk Road. The Silk Road merchandise would normally end up somewhere on the shores of the Aegean Sea or the Black Sea, and from there it would go in ships around Greece to the Mediterranean and back into Europe somehow. A journey of a couple of months, very dangerous. Risk of piracy was great, risk of storms was great. And so he said, well, what if I could offer some of those merchants a direct route into the heart of Europe across my land? Well, they would cut months out of their travel, but if I can secure their passage to Wallachia, I said, all right, as far as Wallachia is concerned, there's no danger. Well, that's a tall distance because, like I said, you couldn't cross the borders without being robbed and most likely also killed. So he issued a decree early in his year, in his rental, to say there will be no more bad people, no more bad omens. He says anybody who commits crimes of any nature will be impaled. So he went completely extreme and put prejudice on his problem. Now you say, oh, he shouldn't have done that. That's not nice. Well, then he would have been forced to take one of the other two choices against Islam, to say, run away or join them. He wasn't going to do that. And there was no other way in which he could restore the economy of the country in a matter of 2, 3, 4 years. I mean, but he did it. And it started kind of slow because people didn't take him seriously. So they said, yeah, we've heard this stuff before. And they went on killing each other and robbing and so forth. And he sent these troops out there and collected a few of his bandits and inquired, what did you do? Well, you know, what? They stole a cow or whatever. All right, on the stage here. But everybody went, oh, wait a minute, you know, that's never happened before. Well, it's happening now. Were you warned? Did you hear the royal order? Yes, I did. Okay, that's it. There's no forgiveness. So he went to that program, and he did execute thousands of these people who just would not listen. And then, I think it took him about a year and a half or so, maybe two, and criminality went down to zero. They said, and these are stories even told by his enemies, and when enemies tell good things about you, they're more credible than when your friends tell. They said that one of the famous anecdotes is that he placed a gold chalice on the rim of a well in the middle of a forest, one of the forests that are the most dangerous place, and left it there. Just a year later, it was still there. People would not go to take water from that well just so that they wouldn't be seen by somebody and accused that they tried to steal it. The result of the extreme law and order was that merchants died started to flow through and across Wallachia. And he managed to raise a lot of money and purchase himself something like 30,000-40,000 horses and weaponry and so forth. So by the time the Turks invaded the summer of 1462, he was ready to face them with whatever could be done by then. His army was only about 33,000 people. Mehmet came with 120,000 plus maybe another 80,000 camp followers and logistics personnel and so forth.
and you see that extreme disproportion of forces. So now, the interesting thing is that the name of the impaler, the nickname of the impaler, was given to Vlad by the Turks, because the Turks had spies there. And they said, how can this guy do this to his own people? And in fact, after that big confrontation with that in summer of 1462, Mehmet came across the forest of his real people that said he went on from my to something like 30,000 people. Now, those are not all Valachian bandits. There were many of them prisoners that had been instantly be taken from the Turks, so there was a mixture. But there were plenty of some Romanians up there from the years, because they left the bodies up there on the state for years. So Mehmet allegedly looked at this forest of his male people and said, anybody who can do that to his own people cannot be defeated. And he turned back and went to his temple. So, this is why, Jay, the level of violence and cruelty that he has to show that the people was justified by the economical program and had no other alternative. And it's also why the larger number of people killed in a short amount of time and displayed or respect is what made the fame that lasted now 500 years. Other people killed probably more. Other people, but that's what they killed. 10 times more than Vlad did. But the way he did it, the style, in your face, relentless and unforgiving is what gave him that reputation that will probably never die. Does that answer your question, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you actually answered another question I was going to ask, is how good of an administrator he was and how good of a king was he. And you answered that by how he recouped his economy in just a few years. So we can't ask that question. But the vampire part of the story, now the vampire was the story that all cultures have, and it's certainly sometime before Vlad's rule. So what sort of legends went on to Vlad? What sort of powers did they assert with him in being, not just the Impaler, but did they give him, supernatural powers? Did he even really have them, but they thought he had?
They described to him supernatural powers for a variety of reasons. One is that there were several attempts on his life that were, should have succeeded. There's one incident where he went to one of his enemies' estates. One guy who was a sworn enemy of his. He went there without a bodyguard. And everybody says, what's going on? He went there, and they set up a table for him, wine, food, and so forth. And then he asked the man of the mansion to lend his blood, his barber, to give him a shave. And the barber came and shaved Vlad's chin. First, not his mustache, he had a pretty glorious mustache. Gave him a good shake. And people said, how could he dare do that? The guy could have put his foot right there and then. They didn't. They were so taken aback by the third that they said, there is nothing here. We better not touch this. And they should have won it. The other thing is that, by surviving, on his life, people said he was indestructible. The other thing is the fact that he used to hang around with people like soldiers and simple people, many times sleeping on the floor with them on the ground in campaigns, without being afraid of anything. They said he cannot be normal. A normal person would not do that because it's too risky. Well, one of the things that there's one more incident. And this happened in one of his very dark moods because he had some losses that I won't go into right now because I don't want to spoil it for my readers. But he was very broken up inside, love story, I should say. And by himself. I mean, he would go with his entourage, some of the people that you have met in the book, and he would force them to remain at the bottom of the path there, and he'd drive into the forest by himself, and then go into a cave and hide in there for a couple of days to sort of mull over his problems and maybe regain his strength. Well, apparently, in one such incident, the woodsman saw him go in and waited to see what was going to happen, and it said a couple hours later, a wolf came out of there. Now, it says that he's got a legend, and nothing will. So, was he the wolf? Was he a shape shifter? Was the wolf just like having a bad day and to wake up when he got in? I don't know, but it's definitely food for thought. And so this legend gets spread and spread. And then the other thing is when you are in close combat and, you know, he was the man who led from the front. This was killed. And it's completely covered in blood. Is it possible that it's even my idea in love box and the blood suckers, all of it? The pictures of him sitting under the face is being prepared on that people are trying to keep it in I think that's rough again. He would not have done that from everything I could see. I gathered from several signals that I picked up that he did not like all the execution. You know, it's like, it really went to get the cancer out of his hand. But he had to, you know, buckle down and make things happen in order to improve the economy, as I said. So now the more uneducated people were at the time, the more, you know, like a better imagination they had in terms of empires and so forth. And I was right there for that reason. And as a child, they were telling the stories that before, and they crossed themselves and they were telling the stories that they were doing that they have. One example is one my grandmother had witnessed, she says, when a man in the village who was staying at their house for the night, put in the middle of the night and came back in the morning, completely covered in blood and stress and so forth, and couldn't remember where he was. They believe that he was taken by some kind of a natural creature and then taken for a ride. She probably would. I don't know many other creatures like that. The point of the story is that if beings of this nature survived and occupied until the 20th century, and actually they were there now, then how much stronger would they definitely be in the 15th century?
Mm-hmm. And the thing about the powers and the weapons that come out of in Europe of supernatural creatures, and speaking of which, in your novel, you have a chapter on Grendel. How does this connect? Because Grendel is like 9,000 AD or something like that, and we're talking about for lives.
Yeah. This Grendel, I think, was named for that other Grendel, for the real Grendel. It's in a way, the way I interpret it is that, you know, blood was. When blood was born, it was a prophecy that circulated, not actually 100 years before it was born. It was a prophecy that circulated that foretold the arrival of the king who ruled the land with an iron rod. So, maybe the wooden stake got to be qualified for an iron rod. That's a boring thing. It's got to be a stronger iron rod than what was in ruling his land. So that was 100 years before, and the prophecy goes. The fact that he would step upon the lion, and the lion turned out to be still of the Ottoman Empire. And it took a while for blood to age. Look at the signs that were told, and this effort to finally put it together that he is the man of the legend of the prophecy. Once he adopted that,
saved the land. And I think in the wider interpretation of the prophecy, it wasn't just Malachi he was to save. He was to save Christendom. So once he understood that, it became immortal in his own mind. When he showed them, you know, running into somebody's fear, which of course he wasn't stupid to do, because just because you are given a destiny to accomplish major things, you can block your own destiny by speaking. So once he thought that, he became sort of fearless. Well, in that process of him reaching his destiny, his journey becomes a typical fearless journey that we see throughout history. And you go back to Homer, Iliad, on and on to all the stories that have to do with the great God. They have a common pattern to it. A person who is living comfortably, someone in his own environment, he ends out on the edge of the artistic goal. And then for the next years, he can understand the question. I think this thing has to do a little bit with the idea of, you know, getting back to the womb. But he wants to get back to the womb. In order to get back, he has to accomplish the right thing. Overcome the obstacles that keep coming in your way. And you have on your way enablers and gatekeepers and so forth. That's it. And then finally, when you return and you bring home something that leads you from the message of God, accomplishing something that you didn't see or meant to do. And that's the general plan. Well, I read Joseph Campbell's description of the hero's journey. And I read that after my book, since my son Justin is a big fan of Campbell, and it's so bad, you know, your book sounds like you picked up from Campbell, and I thought, well, I'm not looking at it, and I did. And, but before I read it, as I developed a lot of stories based on historical facts and some of my own extrapolations, his whole journey is a hero's journey. He got the eggs out of Alaska, the hospice for the church, and it took him years to get back, and in that process, you have people that betrayed him, people that enabled him, the lovers that slow down, lovers that beat him up, and so on. Well, among those obstacles, there was a federal guy, which I believe the main source of a most eventually pop up in order to lend emphasis to how dangerous this obstacle was. The federal guy, you know, behind the well, once he was with him, according to Granville's written, and I cannot tell you how this guy was spoiled in Jonas of the Reader, but yes, those things do appear in the follow-up of the fact that I'm not sure.
Yeah, but basically, it's just like Dan brought up earlier with Arthur, it's sort of our thing, the door to the lab.
Yes, very much so. And what I'm trying to say is that this suffering, our nature, that demands that things happen that way. If you look at it logically, it almost cannot be any other way for the hero. You can't be a hero sitting at home on your own throne doing nothing. You have to be exposed to danger. And if you are one of those heroes who manages to come to the surface, but when you go into something that you never hear from them again, so they call you not blessed, but those who do, to complete the therapy, and to keep all the skills, and to become legendary. Thus, you have a unique spirit, and, you know, you have some of the folks I'd love to say that they're not
so, tell me a little bit about his family. We talked a little bit about his parentage. What about George?
Well, the only documented, truly documented or official thing is the descendant of his that may have become about 70 some years later. But he was nicknamed the Little King. I was a little bit in Romania, the Vlad Romania. Yes, he was. That other guy was called Stepan Luke. The Little Stepan. He did not.
might be my sister. There are other descendants of Yisroel Lover. We have a coach that is today Russell. Popped up only in the last 40 years or so as a historian from Russell uncovered some documents
was born.
showed you the house where he lived, and, you know, the open plot that was fucking displaying the Indians and cowboys of the time. Definitely, they think one of the most well-preserved medieval towns in the world. So, it is very third world. You don't expect a lot of London, but I can say over this January. I'm going there myself next year because it's my 60th anniversary since I defected from Romania, and I'm going to make a bit of a tour to the old haunt. So back to the subject. The gentleman who is the great-great-grandnephew, I hope I'm going to be great-great-nephew of the nephew of Bram Stoker. Yeah. He's the main development story related to Dracula, and he's also promoting Bram Stoker himself. Well, he has done several trips to Romania, he's organized his trip, obviously that's the management of the castle, and I think it's very good that he's doing because he's every step in place as opposed to just saying, I don't know, I'm not doing it. So, yeah, but I'll give you something else that everybody can do without a doctor, so they say, Halloween costumes is about the largest in the world. So if you can go there, you can party on Halloween night in the town of where Dracula was born, I think that will be something you'll never forget. It's probably not that many money, but hotels in Romania are relatively cheap, pretty cheap. You probably will never get a hotel inside the town itself, but I'm sure they have either renovations or rent a car or something. But go there. I have never been there, but I would imagine exactly what to do in the middle of the night. And imagine that you are in a place where the biggest, baddest empire of all was born.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country, of course, particularly. And the women believe the vampire legend and creature legend, you know, of the vampires being immortal and what have you, know, possible to kill. Whether he is a vampire, whether he really has supernatural powers, he's immortal. I mean, you just think about it. We're talking about this guy 500 years later.
You can count on probably the fingers of two hands how many, well, maybe not even two hands, how many people have captured the popular imagination to this extent. You know, you could say everybody has heard of Caesar, but people don't get a copy of a Caesar, you know, like, Yeah. He got killed. That's why he's famous to most people. Now, he happens to be a great man, but how many people have kept his that much imagination? I'm telling you, I worked for a Japanese company for 27 years. I traveled to Japan at least 100 times, and I used to, on my day job, take their train and go to the small towns, and I learned to be Japanese, and then I would talk to kids. I always said, first of all, they look at me, and those are people who have seen me. I have an iPad, so I look like a spider. So, very big in the response, you can see it myself. Kids from the age of 3 on know about the pirates, and they look at me and say, I'm Bobby, a pirate. So, it was easy to make these connections. And I would ask him, have you heard of Dracula? And he said, yeah, Dracula. Well, I did a mission in Africa. I went to several countries in Africa, and I would ask the kids, you know, that? Of course, you know, that. So, then another question. I'm not with anybody other than maybe Mick Jagger. I don't know if there's anybody else. Even for what we find at some law now, the younger generation is so, you know, in another country, they have been living. But this man has managed to penetrate the consciousness of the world. I think it's astounding. And probably, I mean, if you try to keep reading there, maybe the disciples to be supernatural thing. I mean, who are we to tell? As an author, I look at historical facts, and in between 2 miles, I don't have a lot of information. I do what I call reverse engineering. I look at all logical situations and all other factors, and I triangulate them to try to say, here is the path that makes the most sense. Well, I would say to our listeners, if you've heard my story, you've heard other stories, so forth, you have yourself to do that, to say, put those things together and draw your
he was not a vampire, then I cannot tell you that he was. If you can make up your mind based on you're an intelligent person, you can put the facts together, and you extrapolate the man, and you will be the person that keeps you the most. And that's the correct conclusion.
Yeah, how long was he doing? Like 30, 40 years?
Oh, no, it was only 6 years.
Even if his real was 30 years, to be such a, a man, you can go anywhere in the world without, you just said someone who doesn't know about that. You can find exactly what merchandise gets on everywhere on the planet.
And that's where the do we have the anecdote about the wife of the moment who threw herself out of the horses into the river and believed it's a postponed place and probably the third for calling it something and she didn't want to be a prisoner and threw herself in. To this day, the famous road is called Rue Duapne, which means the river of the lady. And in this case, the lady means the queen lady.
Everybody remembers from Randy Forthope's story, and that story in there. Hey, Richard, did you ever see Werner Herzog's Nosferatu, the one with Fox and T.A.'s Nosferatu? Have you ever had a chance to see that one?
I must have seen, I think I did it, but that's quite a few of it.
Color, the color Nosferatu, or something to see this with Empire. That's one of my favorites ever. Right now, they're making two more Nosferatu. The guy who is the witch is making a Nosferatu and some other guys. There's two more. The guy that plays that creature from The Shape of Water, I think his name's Doug Jones, but one of those is going to be Nosferatu. Oh, yes. It's always interesting. My favorite sports opera is that, so I love it because it does a good job of intertwining the historical with fantasy. You're not doing that to do that. I think you did a really good job with that. That's something I can watch you for. There's a guy on my Facebook today telling me he went to see that movie 37 times. I was like, what? Whoa! Wow. He's a bastard. He's a bastard. Of which, in front of the court, that is below the church,
hundreds of skeletons born out of the cemetery. This would have been on the rooftop of the Vatican. That cemetery is closed from the time of Rastogli, because in his lifetime, the
Come on.
He stepped on the ground where Dracula was. And the place was over on the citizens, and the parents decided to close down the cemetery and make it offering to tourists. To my understanding, it hasn't been off the closed until now. So this cemetery has been quiet and unmolested for 100 years. And I write the first book of Dracula, and a week later, the cemetery still has skeletons in the town. Tell me that that is not something related to all the other events that I told you. To me, it's kind of mind-boggling. By the way, this is a document that you can do. If you go Google Wikileaks flood events in 2012, you see dozens of articles about the description. You know, they have equipment out there trying to clean up the mess. People coming from all over the world draw to this thing. And I'm saying, of course, I didn't cause that. I hope not. But somehow, some kind of a magic force is connecting me to this event. Either it's encouraged me, which I hope is the case, or warned. So far, I haven't received a warning. I did encourage myself. I wrote a half a million. Or more already on his life story, and I'm not yet halfway done. Because this man's life is so interesting. I really didn't have to do that much. Of course, you put words in the character's mouth, and you develop their attributes and character. But what?
Deal it?
I don't have to invent them, and they're super exciting.
What mic is it? There ain't no mic, but there's no mics on. I'm not in the studio. All I'm really doing tonight is recording. I'm not really broadcasting much. I'm not sure why you hear anything. But, because I'm still in Atlanta. I'm not even in New Orleans. I'm nowhere around the studio.
No, it's not
really live. I mean, Spreaker might pick it up. I'm not. I'm actually just recording the archives, so I can put them up on SoundCloud and whatchamacallit. Yeah, because I'm looking at Skype's closing. There ain't no other mic, so it's kind of. Yeah, we're just going to use Spreaker tonight. We're just going to record on Spreaker, and that way I can post, because archives are posted to SoundCloud, to YouTube, and all, and I won't have to worry about it, because I'm getting phone call. So, guys, I can't give you an online show, so I'll get back until Monday. No. I'm going to call you and put you on Spreaker through Skype. Yeah, you don't have to do it. No. I'm doing it. It's just for some reason, I don't know why he's getting into the audio, because you would hear us talking right now if the mic was open.
So we'll post the next book in the DraculaChronicles.com. Everybody go to DraculaChronicles.com and pictures book.
I wonder if there's something wrong with the same. And you know what? I've never done this on his computer before either, so it could be some. Yeah, it might be something hard, but we're going to find out all this at the archive in a while. But yeah, I'll call you about 10 minutes. I didn't know that. Yeah, that's even better. Well, that's even better if something goes awry. At least we won't be hurting and getting anybody mad at us. That works for me. I'll call you in a little bit. Yeah. Right. Huh.
Cool.
I'll pull it up in just a second. Let me grab the main email. Yeah, I'm going to do it right now. Grab it in a second. To the JoJo email?
Okay.
Yeah, my brain is... Yeah, my brain is so fried these days, it's not it. Yeah, it's just... Yeah, they, yeah, and I'm not, yeah, and that's the bitch part. I'll be pretty much back and forth from Atlanta, but God knows how. Only on the weekends. Oh, come on, Ken, give me a, you know what, maybe I ain't going to check. I'll wait till we get you on, because apparently I don't want to do it while I got them on the air. Yeah, I think I got this laptop maxed out at the moment. But as soon as I drop in, we'll go check on it and see. Yeah. Well, Terminus I can upload, so that's kind of cool. All the rest of it's just a pain in the ass. Yeah, I'll get it out in a minute too. So once we get them going. Hi, team.
Thank you. Grice a whole lot. She's got those Vampire Chronicles stories. They're doing a show on Paramount Network with that Brian Fuller. He's Hannibal. He's really good, but they're doing that show looking forward to. I've always loved her stuff too, all those Vampire Chronicles books. They probably make that TV show. I don't know when it comes out, but I can't wait. I hope it's good to do. I think Brian Fuller, he did Hannibal, and that was amazing. That Hannibal Lecter show that was on NBC. I can't forget, but it was great. Got wonderful reviews, but not enough viewers, so they can't pull it back to free season. But they are bringing it back somehow, somewhere, at some point. But we appreciate it so much, Victor. Have a good time. Great to have you all.
I look forward to the outside conference of Central. Many of my fans were not able to listen live, and I want to tell them where to go listen to the outside game.
All right, I will let you know about it for sure. Thanks so much. And,
all right, have a good
evening. Everybody, you listen to United Public Radio. You listen to United Public Radio 107.7 FM in New Orleans from the Fast Supernatural Substation. And wait for Joe to give the signal. Well, good thing he's coming in. Thanks, Jay. Great show.
Don't forget, Ancient Aliens in July. Joe Montalvo.
All right. Don't be a hero. I hope you support it. So Victor doesn't kill me, but hopefully he's supporting it. I'm just fine, but I don't know in the world yet. Joe, are you there? Anybody there?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't know. Joe's in Marietta, Georgia. He may not be getting signal.
He probably just stepped away from the computer or something, but I'm sure he'll be back shortly. But we'll just wait and see.
He'll pop on in a minute and tell us we're done, I'm sure.
Listen to the children of the night. Listen to the beautiful music, great lady. But I think you go there one year, but I've got it one year.
Oh, to Romania? Oh, I would love to go. This is gorgeous country. I don't know if I'd go in the wintertime, but it's really fantastic music. There are actually
Before I need to go to vampire shit. Vampire drop shit for a moment.
Yeah, you know, vampire girl.
You stay there and you never leave. I'm not dead.
Well, no. I've always wanted to be immortal, but I don't know if I'd want to be undead immortal.
Rock,
you know, yeah. If you look like Mumra, Thundercats, yeah, that wouldn't be too cool.
That'd be like Wasab or something, yeah, sure. But I'd be called Vampire Company and High by Silver.
Well, you are very tasty.
Yeah. I came back to chemo and I'm probably a vampire.
That's just true, but you do still have very white skin, so maybe you should like tan, they won't.
So, part of it was our black film to go to Dan Rice, so you can run more skin, and I think that I can identify something, or something happened.
I consider myself being a vampire, but as I go out in the sun, I've got tiny jeans, and I turn pretty dark when I get tan.
I burn and
turn
back tail. I don't
can. Typically, I'm Irish, but typically the color of Irish in the sun is a pile of ash.
Look, this recording's okay if you're doing filming.
I hope that it was a great interview. Some of my friends at work are going to want to listen to this.
Yo, where are you?
you were in the void. You know, it would have hung us all up.
You are a void, man. What are you talking about? You're like the black hole of Calcutta. Tell everybody good night. Tell them you love them. You want to have the children. I'll let you know. Well, I mean, it's recording. I'll let you know how it came out when I get a chance to listen.
All right. All right. I'll talk to you later.